I'm Paul Weber. We work with undersea technology. Undersea technology from the Chinese in 1894. We'll come back to that later. Now, as to who am I? I'm a lifetime gamer. Thank you very much. I work in technology development. So I have a very long title, but it comes down to I'm the war game dork in my department. And I'm an extroverted war game dork because when I talk to you, I'll look down at your shoes. So my mantra is, if you want to be a war gamer, if you want to be associated with war gamers, you have to play games. That's the price of admission. If you're not willing to play games, you will never design games. You will never be good at interpreting what comes out of games. So play more games, and games that trick your friends into doing things for you are the best. So I'm going to talk about innovation and technology. My organization, the Naval Sea Systems Warfare Centers, take ships and we, from the R&D stage up to when we tear them apart and throw away the parts, we're the naval organization in charge of that span of activities. So I work in the lower end of what do the platforms of the future need to look like, not should look like, or we would be really cool if they look like, but try and get to what it is they should do. So we look, just to frame where I'm coming from with what is innovation and what is technology, the bottom line is if you're not changing people's behavior, you're not innovating. If you're simply adding things, or you look at these, you know, adding a new thing or changing how to make it appeal to more people, but no one's doing anything with it other than what they're already doing, you've made an improvement, but it's not necessarily an innovation. And the key thing, we all love game changers. Well, what's a game changer? Well, it's an accumulation of the top four types of things into the big innovation of principle. How do I change the way I think about the big picture, not all the little pieces in it? So when I talk about technology, it's not, people think, well, you know, it's the bright shiny object that makes things go boom. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. Technology is an activity, and it includes the techniques you use to do things, the actual thing itself, how you get it, and then within what system do you use it. So when I talk about technology development, it's in the context of this holistic view on technology. So where does wargaming come in? Well, along with Phil, I'm a card-carrying analyst person from the Naval Postgraduate School. Saw some of you here. And I'm a great proselytizer of the cycle of research idea, where wargaming is a piece of a process that has to iterate, that includes analysis, supports and is supported by analysis, and you have to actually go out in the real world and do things. So you need that exercise prototyping piece. And there's different types of thinking that goes along with them, and if you want to catch me after, we can all talk about how great abductive reasoning is. But where this stands in relation to the types of war, as you stay at the very tactical, we have things where we have people that are paid to figure out how to modulate at the millisecond level a sonar waveform, and there's not a lot of decision making in that, so wargaming doesn't apply very much. So at the bottom end of that spectrum, operations analysis tends to dominate, where the human decision making is low. But up at the high end, where you're talking about the political military things, as Stephen points out, there aren't too many experts in thermonuclear war between India and Pakistan, so that's not something you can have a computer spit you out a decision support to. So there's these roles and relationships that are complementary, and they change as the level of problem you deal with changes. So if you take this cycle of research and you blow up the piece between operations analysis and wargaming, you get a span where we like to argue in the wargaming community about what's a wargame? Well, I don't know. We have a bunch of different ideas, but I know there are types of things that are war games. And they tend to vary in the level of abstraction that connects them to reality. So in that middle between analysis and experimentation, you have what a lot of people call exploratory war games that are very abstract. And as you go toward each end of the spectrum, I would argue that they get increasingly bound to reality, either from the point of view of people are thinking very discreetly about the tasks they will do with the exercise in, and people that are instrumenting the games to collect as much data as possible to enable analysis at the other end. The connection here between gaming and all of this is what gaming helps you do as part of those innovations that I talked about. So there's some parts in the that relate wargaming to these innovations of form and kind, but the gaming enterprise doing all those things, just as the types of innovation culminate in the change in principle, if you game, if you perform those activities related to gaming, it helps enable more easily those changes in principle. That's my hypothesis. And we're working on trying to experiment with that hypothesis by the interactive environments for time-compressed collaborative exploration of complex and uncertain decision-driven competitive landscapes. What boss won't give you lots of time to do that? Well, just don't tell them it's a game. So we had all these types of games in the spectrum, so what do you do with them? Well, you use them to support what's actually a fairly standard problem-solving framework where you start with framing the problem and you get to testing the solution. Nothing really new and innovative about that, but what we're innovating on is how do you link that specifically to those types of games and make it part of a process that inculcates the use of those gaming activities to promote an innovative frame of mind, to get people thinking creatively. We say innovation a lot when we mean creative, but I'll confuse the two here like everyone else does. So when we do these things, what are we doing? Well, framing the problem is the most important. And you've seen that in the 1930s, people obviously saw the Chinese submarine tank destroyer and added airplanes to it. So you have to be careful not to take someone else's cockamamie scheme and make it better. That's a failure mode. You can overthink the problem with our seaplane desert aircraft carrier there, if you can't quite see it. So if you overthink the problem, then you're not going to get anything useful. You can take your pet rock, our steam-powered steampunk airplane there illustrates that just because you have what you think is a great idea doesn't mean it applies in every situation. And then, as my friend Chris Weeb likes to point out, there's the problem, the solution in search of a problem. In Star Wars, he wants to know, what is the problem that flying robots carrying buckets of lava is the solution to? So then we explore the problem. Once we framed it and we have some idea of what it is we're trying to deal with, which in these wicked problems wargaming deals with is the hardest part, we'll explore the space. And there's a Hank Brightman at the War College, he loves the liberating structures. There's a whole bunch of different options where liberating structures can help you explore that problem space. What types of solutions, or what are the aspects, jumping ahead, what are the aspects of the problem that are amenable to being solved? What do I constrain it with? What do I declare victory? What are my victory conditions? And then how do I take, since I'm going to be saddled with non-gamers, how do I ease them into the process of leading them to the trough and getting them to drink wargaming? So in our organization, we all have done yellow sticky drills. And one of my arguments to get this going is we've spent upteen thousand hours with innovation cell activities to take hundreds of man hours going into a room, putting yellow stickies on the wall, to the point where we have people that come with the same cluster of yellow stickies from one event to the next and putting them up on the wall and saying, see, that's what the answer was last time. It's still the answer, right? Well, when you bring in new people, they get the yellow sticky brainstorming kind of thing. It may not be the best way of doing things, but it gets their foot in the door. And older guys who have done this before, it gets them to say, oh, I'm familiar with this. Well, let's see where this goes. So there's an exploratory piece to this. And what we found, unfortunately, is that this can often be short-circuited by executive decision. And Stephen likes to say, just stick your foot in the mud and don't move. Well, I like my job, and unlike Stephen, I'm not an independent consultant, so sometimes the executives we work for get to decide, so you have to be willing to do that. I'll call you in, Stephen, the next time I need someone to tell them they're wrong. So then we move to solution framing. Well, bounding the solution space, once you've bounded the problem space, is the next step that leads you to what is the realm of possible solutions. And if you open that up enough, if you think about it in terms of what are the effects I'm trying to achieve, what are the conditions that affect that, what prevents me from getting there, and then what are my alternatives, within that idea of not just what my victory conditions are, but what's my theory of victory? How do I conceive of how I'm getting to that endpoint? And that's where the decision-making and research games come in, where you experiment, in the low E sense, in trying several times, to get to an actionable set of solutions. And they have to be actionable. So you can't just declare victory and say, all your bases are belong to us. You have political scale of things from limited to unlimited, and political in a not just a governmental, but there's an organizational politics that you have to deal with that, particularly with the US Navy, can be perhaps more constraining than the political one. So then we get to the next hard part, the problem framing, the solution framing. Though you can iterate back and forth in that realm several times, and we found that we've had to do that in the two events that we've done. And in some cases, we just iterated that back and forth until we felt we were done, and then we stopped because we didn't really know exactly what to do next. So what we found was, someone else mentioned it, that I think it was Rex, that the game design process is a very effective problem-solving process, where if you can take your problem and create a game about it, you understand it. So if you can create, well, I've got this problem, I've got this solution, how do I make it concrete? Where is the solution? Where am I applying the solution? Where can I create a map, not a geographic map necessarily, but a conceptual map of what is the arrangement of things that I'm trying to affect, and what things within that can I move around and affect? The process of thinking through that, what are the set parameters, the set things, you know, the old, knowing what I can, the serenity prayer thing, what can I affect and what do I have to live with? There's a value in the game design process to help you get there. And I call it a dialectic arena. You know, two ideas enter, a third idea leaves. Or what often is the case, you get 20 ideas enter and three or four leave. So there's a normative process in doing game design where you have a bunch of people with different ideas. We've seen this in some of the game lab things, where everyone may not agree completely, but what they do understand is why they disagree with the other people and agree to disagree to move the process along. So that's a really important piece. So then you explore the solution. You play the game. So we got to the point in one of our events where we essentially designed a matrix game, a fairly simple matrix game, that allowed the different solutions to compete with each other in a common framework. So we had one team play their set of solutions against the problem, against the game, and we had another group of people. So it was like a cooperative matrix game against the game, where they made arguments about why they thought what they were doing in each step of the game was advancing them toward their objective. And then the game read, we had a set, kind of a preset read, we'd look at, based on what Red did in that time step, was it effective or not? And if it wasn't, we'd let him go back and try again. And iterate that over the course of a day. And what it led the more senior guys, and I use these pictures that show, okay, you've got kids playing a role-playing game. Well, you've got guys in uniform that really play role-playing games. And you've got a bunch of competitors in a video game competition that looks like a bunch of guys getting a certification where they're under the gun to demonstrate their proficiency. And you see the same kind of fervor and chaotic behavior in each of those. And then finally you get deliberation, where when you had President Johnson scrutinizing for good or ill the details of the situation, it's very similar to what gamers do when they're deliberating the details of the simulation. The effect may not be a good one, but it's the way things work. And this is where the experimental and analytic games come in, where you need some greater connection to reality when you're exploring the decision space than just considering what the possibilities are. So you increasingly make things more concrete as you move to the ends. It can be moving toward a solution you want to experiment with, or first moving to something you want to analyze. What of the many things we've considered do we want to invest the significant resources in to use the big iron simulations, to use modeling and simulation, to get into the details of whether this thing is it as effective as we thought, or on the exercise end, is actually executable by sailors who are not necessarily competent subordinates all the time, as we'd like to think. But the key to this is this cadre of game-savvy folks. So one of my tasks is workforce development to get people more involved in gaming. So I call this my Maoist insurgency. You know, you corrupt the young, you break the process and cause chaos. And then you hopefully there's a leader to succeed you who will boil out of that. So we have game nights. We try to get, there are gamers out there, they're in the closet. If you can get the gamers in your organization to reveal themselves, you'll find that all of a sudden there's more guys that can help you than you think. If you then get those guys within that community, you'll find one or two guys that, hey, you know, I've got this game and I came up with these ways to make it better. Well, there's a nascent game designer. Some people argue if you play a game, you've thought about how to make it better. But there are those people that have actually tried and succeeded in doing something that's an improvement. Those guys are gold because they understand gaming. They understand that there's reasons to make different games, and they have the power to change it. It's amazing how many people who will play Euro games and simple games, but they just don't even conceive of, well, I could change it. If I don't like something, I could do it differently. The game designer is not going to call me on the phone and say, what are you doing with my game? At least none of them that I've found. The other thing to remember is it takes you some time, even for experienced gamers, for a particular game to get the game. And the first time, usually we like to just call that the beta test, where you get people in the room and they try the game out and you see if it works, so you don't embarrass yourself. But even for the players, you have to get them into the process at least for one turn before they'll actually give you some useful data. So it's that third time that is the charm. And then we come to the solution testing, and this is where I would ask for your help, because this is the hard part. And how do you go and say, I think I've got a solution. How do I test that solution in the broader space of the cycle of research? So part of that is gaming. The way we've gone is we happen to be the virtual world's, you know, virtual environments center of excellence. So we take the employment concepts that the people come up with and have gamed through, and then we instantiate them in the virtual world environment so they can play with them in a more concrete way. It's not a simulation, but it uses some realistic kinematics, but it lets them see how do activities in the submarine connect to activities in the control room, so they have avatars that move from console to console, and you can do virtual experiments that are directly connected to analysis to try and get at the solution testing. But that's only one potential way. We've kind of experimented with that. We don't know if that will all work. But that's where we're at. So, to get you to download my presentation, which has lots of stuff, I have the little write-up about how the Chinese submarine dreadnought was going to win the Sino-Japanese War. So if you download my presentation, I've got a couple of hidden slides in here that can do a few other things. But since I heard the Dalek, I will turn things back over to our panel chair.
Thank you very much, Phil.